flooding over and through his mind.
Swirlings in the Force. Surprise, confusion, darkness, anxiety.
Only what was it? For all the strength of the awareness, the sensation was vague and unfocused. He couldn't tell whether it was a person, a group of people, or something else. Possibly something completely unknown in Jedi or Sith history. And then, as the Darshi darted out the door, and Vader tried to focus on the thoughts and sensations, he heard the distant rumbling of an explosion.
The swirling of anxiety turning to fear, twisting in alien forms and patterns, breaking all ability to concentrate, flashing into unfocused turmoil.
The sudden shift snapped Vader's attempts to isolate it. The distant explosion. Had the aliens attacked the source of the disturbance?
The disturbance dissolving into terror.
A second explosion, as muffled and indistinct as the first, rippled across Black Spire, rattling the cantina.
I believe our freighter has been attacked, Thrawn said coolly, stepping over one of the three Darshi lying unconscious on the floor in front of him. He hurried toward Vader and the door.
Our opponents are attempting to isolate us.
The terror fading, the swirling collapsing onto itself, and silence.
Vader still didn't understand the disturbance. But as the hurricane faded, he made one last focused effort to locate it. And for a single heartbeat, he was able to do so.
No,
he told Thrawn, pointing in the opposite direction from the door.
Not the freighter, the three houses.
Thrawn's eyes narrowed.
Their communications network?
Yes,
Vader said.
And the Emperor's disturbance.
Vader had never seen Thrawn at a moment of complete surprise. Neither had the Jedi. But now, without warning, the Chiss's face went suddenly rigid, his stride jerking just as Vader's had a moment earlier. The moment passed, and he was once again the imperturbable Chiss Grand Admiral. But the moment had been enough.
We must hurry,
Thrawn said, picking up his pace and gesturing Vader to follow. Come. And because Vader was still reaching out to the Force, he felt the flicker of warning. He spun around toward the now empty cantina dining area, the now empty array of tables and chairs, and lifted his lightsaber as a cloud of large insects appeared out of nowhere and swarmed toward them. He ignited his lightsaber, the blade's brilliant glow adding a layer of red light to the relative gloom. Stinging or biting insects were of no threat to Vader himself, protected as he was by his armor. But Thrawn was completely vulnerable to such attacks. Behind Vader and to his side, the Chiss's blaster opened fire, the bolts blazing into the mass of insects. He might as well have been shooting at a sandstorm. The blaster fire caught a couple of bugs, but the targets were too small, and moving too erratically for even Thrawn's marksmanship to make any real difference. Vader stretched out with the Force, trying to shove the swarm into a more compact space. But again, the insect's size and numbers made the effort largely futile. As the swarm reached them, he slashed his lightsaber blade through it, with results that were little better than Thrawn's. The lead group of insects slammed into Vader's shoulder and right arm, and disintegrated into bursts of gray liquid. So, no stinging, no biting, something artificial, bioengineered, or possibly even tiny droids. Acid? Vader peered down at his arm, looking for the telltale smoke as the woven metal, ceramic, and plastoid was eaten away. But again, no. Instead, the bursts of gray liquid had instantly solidified across his arm and elbow, into a sort of smooth gray stone. His elbow? He
tried straightening out the joint as more of the insects slammed into his arm and chest. But it was too late. The elbow was frozen solid.
Thrawn had been right the first time. The attackers were hoping to take them alive. But where were they? Somewhere among the scattering of tables and chairs, certainly. That was where the insects had come from. But there was no one crouching beneath or beside any of the furniture. He snarled under his breath. At least no one he could see. Thrawn's assassin, Rook, had a personal cloaking device. Apparently someone on Batu did too. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw another insect swarm suddenly appear and start buzzing toward them. An instant later, a volley of blaster fire raked the area beneath the tables. Clearly, Thrawn had already come to the same conclusion as Vader, and was hoping a patterned counterattack would take out their hidden enemy. There was a sudden, choked-off scream, and a Darshi body abruptly appeared, twitched violently, then toppled to the floor and lay still.
There!
Thrawn snapped.
There are three more,
Vader snapped back. He still couldn't see them, but he could sense them. Thrawn's response was more blaster fire, this time running a new pattern beneath all the tables. Only there was no guarantee that was where the other Darshi were hiding. The cantina was dark enough that there were several places where they could be standing or crouching unseen, especially if they remained still. Vader had noted that Rook was slightly visible when he moved. If the Darshi didn't move, and if each of them had a canister of insects, he and Thrawn would be immobilized long before they could smoke out their attackers. He looked down at his armor. His right shoulder and arm were rapidly being encased in gray stone, as were both legs around the knees and hips. Clearly, the Darshi had some way to aim the insects' attack. But so far, his left arm was clear. With luck, that would be the last mistake the Darshi ever made.
Visual cover!
He snapped to Thrawn, continuing to swing his lightsaber through the insect cloud as best he could, with only his right wrist still free to move. A couple more insects fell, bursting into gray blobs that solidified before they even hit the floor. An instant later, Vader found himself in the middle of a shower of splinters and dust as Thrawn turned his aim upward and began blasting into the ceiling. For a brief moment, both Vader and the attacking insect swarm were obscured. And in that moment of privacy, Vader reached down with the Force and tore a strip of cloth from the bottom edge of his cloak. Bringing it up, he pressed it against his left arm, loosely wrapping the whole area from wrist to chest plate. The cloth was barely in place when the shower of debris from the ceiling abruptly stopped. Vader looked over to see that the insects had targeted and wrapped Thrawn's gun arm, freeing the elbow and shoulder joints and locking his aim upward. In response, the Chiss had bent over at the waist and was firing more or less blindly in his continuing attempt to take out the remaining attackers. A third insect swarm appeared near the back of the room, followed immediately by a fourth from the far end of the bar. Four Darshi, four swarms. Hopefully that was all of them. Vader continued to swing his lightsaber as far as he could, his range of movement steadily decreasing as the insects splattered against his wrist, adding layer after layer of stone. His lights were frozen, effectively pinning him to this one spot. His left arm was now under attack, with insects throwing themselves at those joints. Two insects headed for his helmet's eyes. Reaching to the Force, he shoved them to the sides. The Darshi might have immobilized him, but he was absolutely not going to let him blind him as well. At his side, Thrawn's blaster fire settled to a single spot as the insects continued to bury him in the quick-setting stone. And then, as the last of the insects expended itself against the two Imperials, there were three brief shimmers from various parts of the room, and three Darshi abruptly appeared. Each held a weapon the size of a blaster carbine, with large attached cylinders beneath the barrels, where the insect swarms had presumably been carried. Walking with what could only be their version of an arrogant swagger, they headed toward their mobilized victims. Vader waited until they were nearly to him. Then, reaching out to the Force, he stripped away the section of stone-hardened cloak that he'd wrapped around his left arm and sent his lightsaber from his frozen right hand to his left. The Darshi had barely enough time to jerk to horrified halts before Vader slashed the red blade through all four of them. He waited until they were lying dead on the floor.
"I presume, Admiral,"
he said into the silence,
"that you no longer require us to take prisoners?"
"I believe this situation has moved beyond that point," Thrawn agreed darkly. "Well done, my lord. Can you summon aid from the Chimera? My comm link is out of reach."
"Summon aid?" Lining up the lightsaber blade with his right elbow, Vader carefully sliced through the gray stone wrapped around it. A quick snap of his arm, and the joint was free. Another slice of wrist and shoulder, and the entire arm was once again fully mobile. Shifting the lightsaber back to his right hand, he freed his legs, then turned to Thrawn. The Chiss was still hunched over, little but his face still visible. He was lucky, Vader thought as he began freeing him, that he hadn't lost his balance and fallen over. It was one thing to lose a battle, as Thrawn had at Attalon. It was worse to lose both a battle and one's dignity at the same time.
"Thank you," Thrawn said when he was finally able to straighten up again.
He sent a quick look around the cantina, then looked down at the freshly dead Darshi.
"Can you travel?"
"Can you?"
Vader countered. Even with his own arms and legs free, he could feel the extra weight of all that stone. Thrawn, without Vader's bio-enhancements or the Force, would be hard-pressed to carry the extra load. Not to mention that he looked less like a living being than he did the midway point of some sculptor's artwork. Though to be fair, Vader didn't look any better. Once back aboard ship, Thrawn could simply change clothing, while Vader would need his armor cleaned in more time-consuming detail. Fortunately, he had another full set in his quarters that he could wear while the Chimera's techs restored this one.
"Of course," Thrawn said.
With an effort, he squatted beside one of the bodies.
"What are you doing?"
Vader demanded.
"The Emperor's disturbance is elsewhere."
"A moment," Thrawn said.
He gazed at the Darshi's knife, gently touched the spot where the scabbard rode the belt, and then drew the weapon.
"Do you see?"
he asked Vader, holding it up.
"I see that you are here while the Emperor's disturbance is not,"
Vader said, putting some anger into his voice.
"Yes,"
Thrawn murmured. He slid the knife back into its scabbard and stood up.
"Let us hope we are not too late,"
he added, as he made his slightly staggering way toward the door.
"Nodlia, do not let anyone remove these bodies." "I'll try,"
the bartender said, sounding doubtful.
"But..."
"You will do as he says,"
Vader ordered, glowering at Thrawn's back as he followed. Had the Chiss been stalling with the whole knife thing, hoping to delay their travel? No. Vader remembered the look on the Chiss's face just before the final Darshi attack. Something about the mysterious houses, the explosion, and the Emperor's disturbance had actually startled him. And anything that could startle Grand Admiral Thrawn was something Vader very much wanted to see.
"I think they've spotted us," Teffen reported from the Dark Hawk's helm, her pleasant alto voice glacially calm. "Reading fresh power transfer in their probable hyperdrive section."
"Copy," Keeman said, cursing silently. The Dark Hawk had an impressively low sensor cross-section,
but eventually even the most observant scan operator couldn't help but notice it. The target was already close enough for Darkhawk's laser cannons to blow it into atoms. But Lord Vader wanted it taken mostly intact, along with at least a handful of surviving prisoners. That meant Keeman's gunners had to get close enough for controlled pinpoint fire. The question was whether they could get there before the target escaped. Lord Vader wouldn't be happy if that happened. And everyone in the First Legion knew what happened when Lord Vader wasn't happy. With an effort, Keeman unclenched his teeth. He was, in fact, the fourth commander this particular unit of the Legion had had in the past 2 years. Two of the others had been demoted and sent back to the 501st. The third had been summarily executed. But for cause, Keeman reminded himself firmly. All three had been replaced for cause, either for incompetence or otherwise failing in their missions. None had been executed simply through bad luck or failure of subordinates. At least, not in this unit. Other units of the First Legion had their own stories. Some of those stories were painful to even listen to.
"Yeah, they've spotted us, all right," Teffen said. "Breaking orbit and grabbing for deep vacuum."
"Yes, thank you, I got it," Keeman
growled, watching the displays, his mind sifting rapidly through the possibilities. The freighter was too deep into Batuu's gravity well to make the jump to light speed, but that particular window was rapidly closing. He checked the displays, hoping Teffen might be able to squeeze a little more acceleration out of the engines. But the Darkhawk was already running full out. Now all he could do was keep going as they were and hope his gunners could rise to the challenge.
"Incoming 180,
Teffen snapped.
"Incoming 180? From behind them?"
Keeman shifted his eyes to the aft display. Just as a flight of four TIEs roared past the Darkhawk, blazing toward the target freighter.
"Whoa," Keeman said. "Yeah, that's incoming and a half."
"I guess the Admiral decided to give us some backup after all,"
Teffen said.
"They came up through our shadow. Never saw them."
Which meant the freighter wouldn't have seen them either, Keeman knew. At least Thrawn's people had some rudimentary tactical ability.
"Commander Keeman,"
a formal voice came over the bridge speaker.
"This is Captain Volt Scaris of Defender Squadron 1. Hope we're not too late to join in. Anything in particular we can do for you?"
Keeman mouthed a curse. Not standard TIE fighters, but a quartet of those TIE defenders he'd heard Thrawn was always going to Coruscant to lobby the High Command for. Which was a complete waste of everyone's time. With the extra weight of shields and hyperdrives, which standard TIEs didn't have and competent pilots didn't need, not to mention the structural changes necessary to switch the design from two wings to three, the defenders were bigger, clumsier, slower, and more expensive than any other starfighters in the fleet. Even the Navy didn't have infinite funds, and with the High Command's passion for bigger and more powerful ships, there was no way even a Grand Admiral with Thrawn's friends on Coruscant was going to get his way. Keeman frowned. On the other hand, given how fast the defenders were leaving the Darkhawk behind, the reports of the craft being waddling ducks might have been a bit exaggerated. Maybe this was his chance to see if the rest of the rumors were wrong, too.
"Looks like they're heading out of orbit and running up their hyperdrive," he called toward the comm. "Lord Vader wants it more or less intact. You think you can pin it to the sky?"
"Exactly what Commodore Pharaoh suggested,"
Scaris said.
"One pinned freighter coming up." "Idiot,"
one of the stormtroopers behind Keeman muttered.
"That's fighter pilots for you,"
someone else reminded him scornfully.
"Twice the mouth because half the brain."
A withering salvo of fire erupted from the freighter, coming from a cluster of laser cannons that the Darkhawk hadn't spotted. The blast slammed into the TIE defenders. The four fighters broke outward in a perfect open rose move, taking themselves out of the vulnerable close-in group formation as they poured return fire into the cluster. There was a second salvo as the freighter reacquired its targets, with the same complete lack of effect.
It didn't get a third salvo before the defenders blew the whole laser cluster into twisted shards. Someone whistled softly.
Damn, things can actually fight.
Looks like it, Keeman agreed. So much for the snide rumors. And now, with the laser cluster silenced, the four defenders proceeded to dig into part of the freighter's dorsal area that Keeman had tagged as being the likely hyperdrive location. A couple of quick salvos into the hull, another pair of slower passes with more accurate fire poured into the gaps created by the first volley.
That should do you!
Scaris's voice came as the defenders delivered one final series of blasts and then veered away.
Aft quarter looks clear. You want us to open up another hole or two so you can get in?
Keeman snorted. Now he was just being insulting. Thanks. We've got it, he said. If you want to be useful, see if you can chase down those four smaller ships. Which were already scattering, he saw, in response to the attack on their friend. At their current distance, there wasn't a chance in the galaxy that the defenders could get to them in time. Scaris presumably knew all that too, but the man was nothing if not ambitious.
Whatever you say,
he said.
The Commodore said we were to render whatever assistance you thought necessary. Have fun. Call us if you need us.
The four defenders made a hard portside turn and shot off on individual trajectories toward the escaping ships. Don't worry, we will, Keeman muttered under his breath. Boarding status, he added, raising his voice. Ready, the boarding master called back. Keeman nodded, checking the readouts for himself. The grapplers that would lock them onto the freighter's hull were armed and ready to deploy. The hatch the Dark Hawk would press itself up against had already been scanned, marked, and patterned for the sizzlers that would burn through the rim and blast it open.
Commander, Teffen called. One of the defenders is coming back.
Keeman looked at the display. What in the...
Sorry, Commander.
Scaris's voice came again.
I've now been ordered to open fire on the forward starboard hatch and see if we can convince them you're coming in there instead of the aft starboard. Hang off a second, okay?
Not okay, Keeman snapped. Get your butt out of my combat arena!
Commodore's orders,
Scaris said firmly, making no effort to alter course.
Podiri, lock onto him, Keeman ordered the gunner. Scaris, break off or I swear I'll blow you out of the sky.
Oh, I wouldn't do that,
Scaris warned calmly.
Grand Admiral Thrawn wouldn't like it if you accidentally scratched my hull. I'm guessing Ruch would have something to say about it, too.
Keeman frowned.
Ruch? What did Ruch have to do with this?
What the hell?
Someone in the rear of the staging chamber snarled.
Hey, Commander. Look what the Tuca cat dragged in.
Keeman stood up, craning his neck as he looked between the row of stormtroopers waiting to make their assault. Coming up from the direction of the engine compartment were Veek and Jid and the damn Nogri.
What the hell? Keeman demanded.
Yeah, I just said that.
Veek bit out.
He was standing outside the engine room door, like he was waiting for someone to notice him.
Keeman looked back at the target freighter, which was now rotating in a likely and futile effort to bring another undamaged laser cluster to bear. Teffed was looping the Dark Hawk around to compensate. So was Scaris's defender.
60 seconds, Commander,
Teffed warned. Keeman turned back to Ruch. He didn't have time for this.
You two, sit on him, he ordered Veek and Jid. He stays in here!
You need my help, Ruch cut in. The Grand Admiral would want me with you.
He stays in here,
Keeman repeated between clenched teeth.
Even if you have to shoot him.
He leveled a finger at the Nogri.
And you,
he added darkly.
If you get out, I'll have those two men shot. Think about how you'll explain that to Lord Vader, because I guarantee Thrawn won't intervene on that one.
For a few seconds, Ruch just stared at him. Then he lowered his gaze to the deck.
It will be done, Commander,
he muttered. Good, Keeman said. They're going to babysit you anyway.
30 seconds, Teffen called.
Strap him in, Keeman ordered, sitting back down and strapping himself into his seat. Teffen was famous for not caring how hard she hit during boarding ops. The freighter loomed ahead. Out of the corner of his eye, Keeman saw Scaris's defender raking the forward hull with laser cannon fire. Teffen made a final tweak to the Darkhawk's trajectory, and with a jolt that rocked Keeman right to his teeth, they were there. The soldiers at the grappler stations were ready. The Darkhawk had barely started to bounce back off the freighter's hull when it jerked again and came to a second, less violent stop against its target. There was a slight vibration as sealant spewed out around the Darkhawk's oversized hatch, forming an airtight barrier between the two hulls.
Seal good,
one of the grapplers confirmed as the stormtroopers popped their straps and readied their E-11 blaster rifles.
Opening hatch!
The Darkhawk's hatch slid open. Keeman stepped to the center of the squad as it formed up, confirming that the freighter's hatch was completely enclosed by the Darkhawk's larger opening. That was good. If the hatch was only partly visible, the stormtroopers would have to cut through a section of hull metal to get in, a much slower and trickier procedure. The grapplers were already spreading sizzler paste around the hatch's inner rim, while a third stormtrooper attached the detonator to the section of paste already in place.
10 seconds,
Keeman warned. The key to successful boarding ops was to hit hard and fast before the enemy had time to set up a proper defense. 8 seconds later, the sizzler paste erupted in an acrid blaze of light and a halo of sparks. Keeman keyed his helmet's optics down a bit, ready to turn them up again once the paste burned down. A second later, the hatch blew. The Darkhawks deliberately increased air pressure, sending it tipping over into the freighter's entryway. The first two stormtroopers charged through the opening, their armor brushing against the remnants of the paste. Their E-11 spitting fire at the aliens crouched in the entryway and pressed against the walls of the passageway leading deeper into the ship. Two of the aliens jerked and dropped to the deck as the Imperial fire found its targets. The two stormtroopers breaking to either side of the opening to allow the next in line to join in the fight. Blaster fire stabbed through the air toward the stormtroopers and was answered in kind. By the time Keeman's turn came, the initial skirmish was over. The aliens lay motionless on the deck, their weapons scattered around them.
Engine, hold, clean up, go!
Keeman ordered, glancing around. Given the unknown ship configuration, the first two squads would be running mostly on guesswork as to where exactly the engine room and cargo holds were. The cleanup squad would have an easier time, confirming enemy dead, collecting weapons and equipment for later analysis, and securing the Darkhawk and their exit point. With the cargo hold squad behind him, Keeman headed out. After having to burn through 8 aliens at the hatch, he'd expected resistance to continue at a reasonably stiff level. To his surprise, they encountered only a single pair of aliens guarding one intersection along the way. To his surprise and his suspicion, unless this species had completely missed the concept of a layered defense, they were probably shepherding their resources for something serious. He and his squad rounded a final corridor, and there they were, 8 meters away. 8 more aliens, standing or kneeling around a pair of tripod-mounted heavy blasters in front of a large metal hatch. Even as Keeman and Podiri did a quick backpedaling, the passageway erupted in a barrage of blaster fire.
I think we found them,
Podiri offered helpfully as he and Keeman pressed themselves against the wall. Bits of metal and ceramic spattered from the corner as the fire ricocheted from the edge.
Grenades? Waste of good explosives,
Keeman said, crouching down.
High cover! Right!
Leaning out just enough into the corridor to see where he was shooting, Podiri opened up with a volley of fire into the crowd. And as the aliens concentrated their attention and firepower on him,
Kiemann leaned out and sent a three-shot into each of the heavy blaster's power packs. He and Podiri barely got back around the corner before the packs exploded. Kiemann waited until the sound of the blast had faded away before peering around the corner again. The blasters were gone, their death throes having decorated the walls, ceiling, and deck with blackened shards. All eight aliens were down as well, stretched out across the deck. Three were still twitching. The others weren't.
"Come on,"
Kiemann ordered, keeping an eye on the injured as he rounded the corner and headed for the control panel beside the metal hatch. Oddly enough, it seemed to have been hardly touched by the twin explosions. There were two control buttons on it, plus a small display labeled with squiggly alien writing. Mentally flipping a coin, Kiemann pressed one of the buttons. The hatch slid open. The first and second stormtroopers in line went down instantly in the firestorm that erupted from the other side of the hatch. The next two Imperials dropped to one knee, opening up the field of fire for those behind them. One of the kneelers took a concentrated burst in his chest plate and toppled over. As the rest of the stormtroopers opened fire, Kiemann slapped the other button, sliding the hatch closed again and cutting off the battle. Apparently, they did understand layered defenses.
"Two E-webs to the hold,"
he snapped into his transmitter.
"Troopers, I saw 10 in the firing lane,"
Mortik said, getting awkwardly to her feet from her knee-down position. She'd taken some shots to the helmet and chest, too, but was still functional.
"Two more heavy blasters, plus rifles. Hold went back about 40 meters,"
Trooper Dorstin spoke up.
"Twin lines of cylinders along the walls. 5 meters tall, maybe 3 in diameter. Another 8 to 10 aliens working on them."
"Not just working,"
Trooper Ellaby added grimly.
"I'm pretty sure they were rigging them with explosives."
Kiemann swore under his breath. So they were trying to destroy whatever it was they were carrying. Lord Vader wouldn't like that at all. "Can't wait for the E-webs," he decided. "Assault formation!" 10 seconds later, they were ready. Three loose lines, prone, kneeling, and standing, with the stormtroopers spaced far enough apart to deny the aliens easy group shots. Readying his own E-11, Kiemann slapped the hatch control. Nothing happened. He tried again, then tried the other control, then went back to the first. Nothing! Apparently, the aliens had let him open the hatch the first time just so they could launch their attack. Now that the element of surprise was gone, they'd gone for a lockout. Sergeant Drav was already on it.
"Grenades at breakpoints,"
he ordered.
You and you, move it, troopers!"
"Belay that,"
Kiemann said as the three troopers stepped up to the hatch. During the brief moment the hatch had been open, he'd seen the thickness of the metal, the honeycomb cross-section pattern, and the slight inward curvature.
"Grenades won't breach it. They'll just open up gun ports."
"Which we can shoot through as well as they can,"
Drav countered.
"Which won't help us save the cargo,"
Kiemann shot back, trying to visualize the freighter's architecture. If he was right, it was worth a shot. He keyed his helmet's long-range transmitter relay.
"Scaris, you still out there?"
"Right here, Commander,"
the TIE Defender pilot came back promptly.
"What do you need?"
"I need you to blow out the ventral cargo hatch,"
Kiemann said.
"Can you do that?"
"Probably,"
Scaris said hesitantly.
"Lord Vader wanted the cargo intact."
"The crew's trying to blow it up,"
Kiemann said.
"I figure a little explosive decompression will discourage that."
"Got it,"
Scaris said.
"Coming around now." "Whoa."
"What?"
"The second freighter's coming back up from the surface,"
Scaris said.
"You want me to chase it?"
Kiemann bared his teeth. Last indications from the Chimera had been that that second freighter was heading to the same general area where Thrawn and Lord Vader had landed.
"Can you get to it before it makes the jump?"
"It'll be close. No one else is in position. They're still off chasing the smaller ships. Tell me what you want me to do."
"Stay here and blow the hatch,"
Kiemann said, making another quick decision. Whatever that other freighter had been doing, chances were Lord Vader was already on top of it. This one, though, was Keeman's.
And make it snappy!
The words were barely out of his mouth when a muffled blast rattled the hatch, shaking the deck beneath Keeman's feet.
Never mind. Damn it all!
Yeah, got it.
Scaris growled back.
Hull and cargo hatch look damaged, but still airtight if you want to go in. I'm guessing there won't be much opposition. I'll go see if I can chase down that other freighter.
Yeah, do whatever you want,
Keeman said, motioning Drav and his grenades back to the now visibly warped hatch. They'd go in all right, and they'd see if there was anything left to find. Lord Vader wasn't going to be pleased. At all. And maybe the squad was about to get its fifth commander. Chapter 9. There had been three houses in the clearing when Thrawn and Vader approached from orbit. Now, a single house stood beside two piles of flattened rubble.
It is gone,
Vader said.
His voice deeper than usual. Perhaps it holds anger. Perhaps accusation.
The disturbance has disappeared.
Yes, Thrawn said. The rubble shows evidence of blasts delivered from above. It shows further evidence of compression, also from above.
How do you know that?
I believe the source was taken, Thrawn said. Observe the pressure indications across the area of destruction. The first two houses were destroyed in order to make room for the freighter to land beside the third.
Vader faces the destruction. His fingers rest near the hilt of his lightsaber.
You believe the source was inside the third building?
Did the disturbance break off suddenly, as if destroyed in an explosion?
No,
Vader said.
His voice grows clearer. Perhaps he has followed and accepted the logic. Perhaps he's preparing for more questioning.
Do you know the source of the disturbance?
I have a thought, Thrawn said. I would prefer not to state it, so as not to influence your own thoughts and analysis.
Vader turned to face him.
I would prefer that you do.
I do not wish to influence your analysis. For 3 seconds, Vader remains silent. His hand rests openly on his lightsaber.
Many years ago, the Emperor asked you what you would do if faced with a choice between the Empire and the Chiss. Do you remember that question?
I do, Thrawn said. I replied that if I were to serve the Empire, he would command my allegiance.
And?
My word is my guarantee, Thrawn said. If his servant Anakin Skywalker were here, he would speak to that guarantee.
Anakin Skywalker is dead.
So I have heard, Thrawn said. I also have the Emperor's trust.
Do you?
Vader countered.
After Atalon, do you still have his trust?
Yes. Vader is silent another 2 seconds.
You must still earn mine.
He pauses, his head inclining slightly.
Commander Keeman reports that the freighter that was here has escaped into hyperspace. He further states that the other freighter's crew has successfully destroyed their cargo.
They will certainly have tried. But even the most thorough destruction may leave clues.
You have a reputation for seeing that which others do not.
Vader removes his hand from his lightsaber and waves toward the remaining building. His voice perhaps holds challenge.
You will begin here.
The house was a common design. There were 5 sleeping rooms holding a total of 20 beds, a large common area, a combined food preparation and eating area, and 3 bathrooms. Two other rooms contained crates which appeared to hold mostly food and household supplies.
These four beds have been recently slept in,
Vader said, as they looked into one of the sleeping rooms.
Their occupants appear to have departed quickly.
I agree, Thrawn said.
The style of the building, the design of the furniture, and the patterns of color and line were consistent with what he'd seen elsewhere in Black Spire. Local design and construction, offering no clues as to the occupant's origin. He pulled several of the garments from the sleeping room lockers and laid them out on the bed for study.
Admiral,
Vader called. His voice perhaps holds cautious excitement.
Come to the rear of the house.
Vader was waiting in a wide archway leading into a long room.
Do you recognize these?
He asked. There were 10 cylinders laid out in the room, lying on their sides on support cradles. Each was 6 meters long, consisting of a central portion 2 meters long, with a swing up top and a 2-meter-long metal cap on each end. Power cables and liquid delivery tubes were arrayed neatly around and between each cylinder. The tops of all 10 were open, revealing contoured body couches inside.
I have not seen such devices before, Thrawn said. Could they be cloning chambers?
They are smaller than any known Imperial design.
He steps to one and stoops down, peering first into the open central chamber, then shifting his attention to a control board below the lid.
Do you know this script?
He asked, stepping aside.
The script is common in the unknown regions, Thrawn said. But I do not recognize the language. An examination of the internal equipment may reveal its use.
Vader held out a hand toward the cylinder. For a moment, the cylinder shook gently, then lifted a few centimeters from its cradle. It tilted a few degrees left, then right, then settled again onto the cradle.
The bulk of the mechanism is there,
he said, pointing to the left cap, the one at the foot end of the central couch.
The other end is mainly liquid storage.
How do you know?
The inertial characteristics of solids and liquids are different.
His voice perhaps holds confidence, perhaps rebuke.
I see, Thrawn said. We need to bring one to the Chimera. Perhaps the engineers can ascertain its function.
Agreed. Guard them while I bring your freighter.
There is no need for a guard, Thrawn said. I will return to the cantina and examine the bodies.
We will return together.
His voice is again dark.
We will also question the bartender further. It may be he knows more than he has yet said. After the cylinders have been loaded aboard the freighter.
Very well, Thrawn said. But be quick. Time is not on our side. For 2 seconds, Vader stands motionless.
I will return at my own pace.
His voice perhaps holds anger, perhaps grudging agreement.
And that pace will be sufficient.
Transmission is secure, Admiral,
Farrow said, double-checking the readings one last time before turning her full attention to the image floating over the aft bridge holopod. At the Chimera's distance from Batu, a standard transmission cone was wide enough to invite local eavesdropping, and even with encryption running, it wasn't a risk anyone wanted to take.
Orders?
Information, Thrawn corrected. What of Commander Kimund and his assault on the freighter?
The First Legion has captured it, Farrow confirmed. The cargo hold was destroyed, though, and there's not much left in there to examine. Kimund has the vessel under power and is bringing it in.
I assume you sent assistance.
Farrow felt her lip twitch.
I sent four TIE defenders, sir, she said. They were unable to significantly affect the outcome.
I doubt that, Commodore,
Thrawn said calmly.
Even if they merely drove off reinforcements to the freighter, they nevertheless contributed to its capture. Did Commander Kimond take any prisoners?
Yes, sir. He reports they have three, Pharaoh said, feeling some of the tension leave her shoulders.
Grand Admiral Thrawn always saw the big picture, choosing to concentrate on the successes and learn from the failures. Vader, if his reputation wasn't exaggerated, would probably have left a trail of bodies behind him after such a lackluster report. It was entirely possible that he still might.
Excellent,
Thrawn said.
Lord Vader and I will be returning with two cylinders of unknown origin and function. Have one of the mechanical assembly rooms cleared, and a full squad of engineers assigned to learning their secrets.
Yes, sir, Pharaoh said, tapping a quick note on her datapad. Do you wish any cultural downloads sent to you? I have a high-speed transmitter ready.
It was only a small smile, but to Pharaoh it spoke volumes. She had correctly anticipated her admiral's thoughts and orders, and he was pleased.
Thank you, Commodore, he said. Please transmit everything in the files marked Darshi and Borderlands.
Yes, sir, Pharaoh said, making another note. Anything else, Admiral?
Did Commander Kimond get a look at the cargo before it was destroyed?
A brief look, yes, Pharaoh said. He described it as a group of large cylinders.
Really?
Thrawn said.
Bring him into the conversation.
Yes, sir.
Pharaoh keyed her board, lining up another tight beam on the freighter.
Commodore Pharaoh for Commander Kimond.
Kimond's image appeared beside Thrawn's.
Kimond,
the stormtrooper commander said sourly.
Admiral Thrawn, Commander,
Thrawn said, as an image of a cylinder appeared between them.
Is this what you saw in the Phrasis cargo hold?
Kimond leaned forward a bit.
Not really, sir. Ours were much larger.
But were they of the same style?
We only got a quick glimpse,
Kimond said.
But I don't think so.
Did Rook perhaps get a longer or better look?
Kimond's expression hardened.
Did you order him aboard the Dark Hawk without my permission or knowledge, Admiral?
I gave no such order, Commander,
Thrawn said.
Nor did I order him to remain aboard the Chimera. I presume he believed he could be of assistance to you.
I'm sure he did,
Kimond said stiffly.
In the future, I'd appreciate it if you'd permit me to choose the parameters and personnel for our missions.
So noted,
Thrawn said, which wasn't, Pharaoh noted, acceptance of Kimond's request.
And to answer your question, no, he didn't,
Kimond continued.
I had him kept in the Darkhawk during the operation.
Thrawn was silent a moment, and Pharaoh wondered if he would point out that the Legion's attack might have ended differently if Rook had been included. But the Admiral passed up the opportunity.
Very well,
he said.
Continue to the Chimera and put the freighter in the number 6 slot. It may be that the ship and even the hold will yield more secrets than its former owners expect.
He paused.
One other thing, Commander. Keep your prisoners away from viewports or visual displays until you are within half a kilometer of the Chimera. Then allow them to see their destination and observe and record their reactions.
Yes, sir,
Kimond said, frowning.
So we can gauge whether or not they've ever seen a Star Destroyer?
Exactly,
Thrawn said.
It may be most informative. As you were, Commander. And you, Commodore, may send the data files at your convenience.
On their way, sir,
Pharaoh confirmed.
Which data files, may I ask? Kimond put in.
Those of the Darshi and others of this region,
Thrawn told him.
It is possible that we have already met our enemy. It is equally possible that the enemy is yet hidden from us.
He paused, his face hardening.
It is vital that we learn which is the truth.
Nodlia was waiting when Vader and Thrawn returned. The Darshi bodies weren't.
Were my orders perhaps unclear?
Thrawn asked. His voice was calm, but Vader could hear the quiet threat beneath it. So, clearly, could Nodlia.
I'm sorry, my sirs. I'm sorry,
he said, his throat working, his hands twitching nervously on top of the bar.
They had weapons. I had none. I protested, but I couldn't stop them.
Perhaps you should have protested more vigorously,
Vader suggested. He focused on the man's throat, stretching out to give it just the slightest hint of a squeeze. Nodlia's eyes bulged, his hands grabbing futilely at the untouchable grip on his throat.
Sirs, please! I beg you!
Calm yourself,
Thrawn said. His hand moved a few millimeters in Vader's direction. A suggestion. Possibly an order. No matter. Vader had already planned for it to be a small, harmless lesson. The man knew too much to be killed outright. He released the grip, watching as the bartender seemed to collapse a little.
Who are they? More Darshi?
Nodlia nodded, a jerky motion.
Those Darshi,
Vader added, nodding toward three of the aliens who had come in during the Imperial's absence and were now sitting around a back table, nervously watching the newcomers out of the corners of their eyes.
No, not them,
Nodlia said.
Others!
Fortunately, the absence of the bodies is of little importance,
Thrawn said.
I had already seen what I needed. Lord Vader, would you bring me one of the knives from those Darshi?
Vader snorted to himself. One of the knives? Surely the Admiral was joking. Stretching out with the Force, he pulled all three of the weapons from their sheaths and brought them flying to the bar. Thrawn was ready, reaching up one hand to catch the lead knife as it arrowed toward the wall behind the bar. Vader caught the other two. One of the Darshi started to rise from his chair in protest, seemed to think better of it, and sat back down.
Thank you, Thrawn said calmly. Do you see the blade, Lord Vader? And the pattern etched on the metal?
Yes,
Vader said, studying the knives in his hands. It wasn't just simple etching he saw now, but a highly intricate pattern of lines and curves set into the metal.
There is little in the Imperial files on these beings,
Thrawn continued.
But you will immediately see that these knives are not at all like the one I showed you earlier. You will also see that these knives fit the slight curve of their sheaths, while our attacker's knife was too short, too narrow, and with a straight blade. In addition, the grooves worn into our attacker's belt were too deep to have been made by the sheath of a weapon that light. They were created by a knife of this size and heft.
Vader thought back. He'd been distracted at the time, but he saw now that Thrawn was correct.
It was not the knife he normally carried.
Correct, Thrawn said. It was a substitute. The question is, why did he not have his normal knife?
And why did he not use the one he carried against us? Even a ceremonial weapon should be used freely when death is the only alternative.
Indeed. I suggest that someone had taken his normal knife, and that the replacement was there merely for show. Perhaps he feared that drawing it would reveal the deception to all around him.
Interesting. Perhaps the value of the weapons goes deeper than mere ceremony.
A token of honor and family, perhaps,
Thrawn agreed.
Something akin to the Kalikori of the Twi'leks. I note that the etchings on these blades are of different lengths and complexities, which would support the idea that family heritage is a part of the design.
Perhaps we should inquire of them,
Vader suggested, turning toward the three Darshi.
Perhaps we should,
Thrawn said.
Nodlia, which of them would you suggest would be most forthcoming?
Please,
Nodlia pleaded, his voice shaking.
I don't want to be in the middle of this. Not again.
Then tell us what we need to know,
Thrawn said.
Tell us what was in the cylinders the strangers took to the houses.
Nodlia looked at him, then at Vader, taking in the broken coating of gray stone on both of them.
I don't know,
he said, keeping his voice down as if he was afraid the Darshi would hear.
They didn't say. I didn't ask.
Did the newcomers look like this?
Thrawn asked. Holding his holoprojector in front of him, he pulled up an image of a wide-shouldered creature with angled brow ridges, a tapered skull, and deep-set eyes. Nodlia twitched back.
Yes,
he breathed.
That's them. They brought in the coffins, the cylinders. They frightened us.
Vader frowned at the image. The creatures weren't pretty, certainly, but he'd faced plenty of bigger and nastier-looking opponents.
You are easily frightened,
he rumbled contemptuously. Nodlia swallowed hard.
The Darshi were afraid of them,
he murmured.
Some of the Darshi became their servants.
He shook his head.
I've seen a lot of Darshi. Made them drinks. Watched them argue. My experience is that they never serve anyone. Not willingly.
Vader gestured to the image.
One of the First Legion's prisoners?
Yes,
Thrawn confirmed.
Commander Keeman sent it to me while you were bringing the freighter.
He half turned it around to gaze thoughtfully at the alien's face.
So this is a Grisk.
Nodlia inhaled sharply.
That's a Grisk?
What are Grisk?
Vader asked.
Grisks are a species living somewhere in the unknown regions,
Thrawn said. He gazed at the image another moment, then shut off the holoprojector.
Creatures half of myth, whom few have ever seen. It is said that they are nomads with no fixed home, traveling in spacecraft so numerous they blot out the stars. They are said to be terrifying warriors, overwhelming their opponents by sheer numbers and ferocity.
Vader looked at Nodlia. The bartender seemed to have shrunk a little further with every word.
Myths, you say?
Yes, Thrawn said. But many myths are rooted in fact. We must now seek to divide the one from the other.
He laid a coin on the bar.
Thank you for your assistance.
Wait!
Nodlia said, as the chist turned to leave.
That's it? You're just leaving us?
Did you expect that we would stay?
Thrawn asked.
What about us?
Nodlia asked.
What about the Grisks? What if they come back?
Thrawn shook his head.
I do not believe they will.
And if you're wrong?
Thrawn's eyes narrowed, his face hardening. It was an expression the Jedi had seen on him once, a long time ago. An expression that spoke of imminent death.
Because you're leaving a pretty big mess behind,
Nodlia persisted.
We're the ones that have to stay, and...
He broke off, his eyes going wide, as Vader once again squeezed his throat to silence.
You have been given your answer,
the Dark Lord rumbled. Nodlia's head bobbed up and down in a hasty nod, his eyes still wide. Vader held him another moment, then released his grip.
We depart?
He asked Thrawn.
We depart,
Thrawn said. Like his expression, his voice also spoke of death. Come, we have work to do. The first part of the return trip was spent in silence. Vader piloting the freighter, Thrawn gazing at his datapad. From the shifting reflections of light on Thrawn's face, it was clear he was sifting through his artwork collection. They had left Batuu's atmosphere, and Vader had laid in the vector back to the Chimera when Thrawn finally set the datapad aside.
Well?
Vader asked. I believe I have gained some insights, the Chiss said. First, let us discuss the scenario on Batuu. I presume you have reached some conclusions?
I have,
Vader said, wondering darkly if Thrawn was being patronizing. Surely the Chiss had already learned all that there was to learn. The Jedi, certainly, had usually found himself lagging behind Thrawn in such things.
The Grisks hired the Darshi to set up a base and a communications triad at Black Spire. When all was ready, they brought in the cylinders and moved them from the landing field to the house.
And the cylinders are? Vader glowered. This time it was definitely a test.
I believe they are hibernation tanks,
he said.
Perhaps similar to carbonite freezing. The occupants were brought to Batuu, then put inside the tanks for secret transport across Black Spire to the Darshi houses. It was their sudden fear at the knowledge of what was to happen to them that the Emperor detected as a disturbance in the Force.
He paused, stretching out to the Force.
But you already knew they were Force-sensitive, did you not?
In the brief time Vader had spent with Thrawn, he'd never sensed the Chiss's emotions register as more than small and brief flickers against the orderly array of his mind. The flicker he sensed now was also small and brief, but it was definitely there.
I suspected, but did not know for certain, Thrawn said. It is not something we speak about.
Vader's fingers twitched, his eyes and his mind focusing on Thrawn's collar. A servant of the Emperor did not have secrets. Not from the Sith Master's own apprentice. Perhaps a reminder of the Chiss's true position in the Empire was in order. Some pressure on his throat, as Vader had done with the bartender, would bring such things into their proper perspective. He resisted the temptation. The Emperor clearly still considered Thrawn a useful tool. More important, the Chiss had knowledge that Vader needed. So let him play games. Let him even think Vader a simpleton, if that brought them to the Emperor's disturbance and the end of this mission. Better still, Vader would prove that he wasn't as far behind Thrawn as the Chiss tactician perhaps thought.
You will speak of it in the proper time. For now, let us continue. The Darshi plan was to move the cylinders and occupants from Batuu aboard one of the two large freighters. But neither freighter could land with ours in the way. So the Grisks ordered their Darshi and Black Spire to distract us while they destroyed the two houses, which provided them landing space. They then evacuated the inhabitants.
Having been put inside the ship's own hibernation chambers,
Thrawn said.
Yes.
And the same reaction, either fear or revulsion at what was about to happen, was no doubt what Vader had sensed in the cantina.
And the freighter's cargo?
Thrawn asked.
The cylinders the Grisk were desperate to destroy.
That will require further study.
Vader eyed him.
Or do you already know?
I have a thought, Thrawn said. But as you say, further study will be necessary.
He leaned forward and tapped the comm control.
Commodore Farrow.
Farrow here, Admiral.
The Commodore's voice came back promptly. Is the captured freighter secure aboard?
Yes, sir. The engineers have given it a cursory examination and are now assembling the tools and equipment necessary for a deeper study.
The Defenders?
Also returned, sir. Captain Skerris is compiling the pilots' reports on their encounters with the enemy.
Excellent, Thrawn said. Plot a minimum time course back to the point in the Batu hyperlane where we left that path and turn to Mokivja.
Yes, sir.
If Pharaoh was surprised by the order, it didn't show in her voice. Probably, Vader thought, odd orders were the norm around the Grand Admiral's command. Execute as soon as we are secured aboard, Thrawn continued. Inform Commander Keymond and Captain Skerris that we will confer 2 hours after the Chimera has made the jump to light speed.
Yes, sir.
Thrawn keyed off the comm.
2 hours? Vader asked. Their report should be finished in one.
I'm certain they will be, Thrawn said. But I first wish to examine the remnants of the Gris cargo. Vader ran the whole thing over in his mind. So Thrawn wanted to go back to the Batu hyperlane? But not to the point where the Chimera had first been dropped back into real space, which should be an easier and quicker point to locate. Did he expect to find something at the exact point where he'd originally given up the effort? Or was something else going on? Could he be making Pharaoh go to all this effort because he was stalling for time? And if so, why? What could he possibly be stalling for?
And you expect the Batu hyperlane will now be open?
Not at all, Thrawn said. But I believe we now hold the key to its closure.
The Gris and their hibernating force sensitives.
That and more, Thrawn said, his voice going darker. We will know soon if I am correct.
Our first thought was that they were some kind of covert fighter escort,
Captain Skerris said, pulling up the images he and the other TIE Defender pilots had recorded from their encounters with the Grisk freighters.
But it turned out they didn't have much in the way of armament, or at least nothing they were willing to show us. They weren't very fast, either.
His eyes flickered briefly to Pharaoh.
If we hadn't been ordered to assist the Darkhawk, I could have taken out one or more of them.
Pharaoh suppressed a grimace, and that one was squarely on her. She'd given Skerris and the others the order to put the First Legion's mission at top priority, and Vader was standing right there, his helmet turned toward her. There were rumors about what happened to people who displeased the Dark Lord. None of those stories was pleasant. None of them ended well. Keymond was still here, so Vader had apparently decided the loss of the other ships wasn't the First Legion's fault. But Pharaoh had no such guarantees for herself.
The freighter was the more important target, Thrawn said calmly. Would you not agree, Lord Vader?
I would,
Vader rumbled. For another moment, his blank faceplate remained pointed at Pharaoh. Then he turned to Skerris.
Flight characteristics.
Unimpressive, my lord, Skerris said. They look like small, heavy-load transports, and that's exactly the way they seem to handle.
He touched a spot on one of the images.
For what it's worth, all of them had just the single cargo hatch, and it was big enough to handle the cylinders Commander Keymond saw on the freighter.
He looked at Keymond, and for a moment Pharaoh thought he was going to add, before the Grisks blew them up. Fortunately, Skerris, for all his arrogance and propensity for ignoring officers, wasn't the type for cheap shots. Neither, apparently, was Keymond.
I concur with Captain Skerris's assessment, the First Legion commander said. I also agree with his conclusion that none of these ships were particularly well-armed. They seemed to be at Batu for a pickup, nothing more, and weren't expecting trouble.
Given the bartender's comments about the fear the Darshi and Grisks engendered in Blackspire's residence,
Thrawn said. I'm certain they did not anticipate resistance.
Maybe not, Keeman said, his voice going a little sour. But they were sure ready in case it happened. By the time we got to the cockpit, the entire computer system had been wiped clean, and every bit of electronics had been fried. In fact, there were places where it looked like they'd taken literal flame to the walls and equipment.
Yes, I saw, Thrawn said, nodding. They were no doubt attempting to destroy any evidence of their point of origin.
Including themselves, Keeman said. They were throwing themselves at us during the incursion, and I don't think it was just to slow us down. I think they all wanted to die fighting so that we wouldn't have anyone to interrogate. The only reason we have any prisoners at all is that we caught three of them still working on the electronics wipe, and were able to get into stun range before they could get to their weapons. Which were DL-18s and old DC-18s, by the way, he added. Probably locally bought.
So what exactly were they supposed to pick up on Bat-2 that was worth all that?
Scaris asked.
Do we know?
I believe we do, Thrawn said. To clarify, though, I believe they were at Batuu for both pickup and delivery. Consider that several of the small transports were already on the ground near Blackspire. I believe the plan was for the first freighter, the one Commander Keeman captured, to remain in orbit and transfer one cylinder to each of the four smaller transports that had just arrived.
They did look like they were moving toward the freighter when they spotted us and started running,
Scaris said. Indeed, Thrawn said. They would have begun with the four already in space, then continued with those waiting on the ground, which would presumably join the freighter in orbit at their own schedule. The second freighter was to land and gather the... His eyes flicked to Vader. Grisk's prisoners, bringing them to orbit, and likewise transferring one to each transport.
All of it taking place off the ground, where the locals wouldn't get a good look, Pharaoh said.
So who exactly are these Grisks? Keeman asked.
Very little is known for certain, Thrawn said. But some things can be deduced.
He touched a control, and the conference table's holoprojector lit up with a series of images.
These are some of the artistic pieces that have been created in memorial by survivors of Grisk conquests. Compensating for the creator's cultural biases and patterns, I believe that the tales of vast hordes of the enemy are inaccurate. More likely,